Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. First of all, I'm kind of amused, if not a little disturbed, by the confusing reporting that's coming out in the last hour about the Supreme Court's affirmative action decision. We just heard on NPR News how they sent it back to the lower court, this University of Texas case, saying they lean too much in the direction of upholding the affirmative action program of the University of Texas and should have given that program greater scrutiny. We had seen something else from a reputable source that analyzed it as this 7-1 majority of the court upholding the value of diversity and saying universities can take diversity into account as a value and a goal that was considered in jeopardy in this ruling. So guess what? It's a long, complicated ruling. We have a Supreme Court reporter reading it right now and coming up in about a half hour after he has had time to really digest it and hopefully give you some true clarity on it. We will dissect this Fisher versus University of Texas at Austin Supreme Court affirmative action ruling. So calm down, everybody, and we'll give you an answer in about a half hour that will hopefully be right. Meanwhile, once again, the United States is having a debate about moral behavior in the war on terror. This time it's about electronic surveillance, as you well know. It's also been about drones, including so-called signature strikes on groups of people rather than individuals, plus interrogation techniques, secret prisons, indefinite detention without trial, Guantanamo Bay. And, of course, the question that goes with the morality debate, what works to keep us safe from al-Qaeda-style violent radicalism, foreign or homegrown? Well, my next guest knows it all from the inside. We are happy to have a rare opportunity to talk with a central figure in counterterrorism at the CIA and FBI in the Clinton, Bush, and Obama administrations. I think he actually got into government, this kind of work, back under Reagan. Now out of government and author of a new book called Takedown, Inside the Hunt for al-Qaeda. Philip Mudd's positions have included Deputy Director of the Counterterrorist Center at the CIA and Deputy Director of the National Security Branch at the FBI. And he is now an independent consultant and research fellow at the New America Foundation. Mr. Mudd, thanks very much for coming on and welcome to WNYC.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And listeners, as I said before the news, and I hope Mr. Mudd is game for this, anything you always wanted to ask a top CIA and FBI counterterrorism official but had none at your dinner table, now's your chance. Ask Philip Mudd anything. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. I assume you have the prerogative to secure classified information, but about the hunt for bin Laden, about pre-9/11, about today's controversies over drones and surveillance, your call when you make the call, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And I read in your book, you describe at the beginning how you started life as an English literature major in college. So
right.
Did something about Shakespeare or Moby Dick make you want to be a spy?
No, something about having employment did. I wanted to teach high school students. My specialty was actually not Shakespeare. It was, believe it or not, Victorian novel, 19th century British novel. But I couldn't get a job. I was rejected by 30-something high schools. And I started work at a small newsletter company in Washington, which was a horrible job. So my dad called me one day and said, hey, there's this place called the CIA that's hiring. I had no idea or very little idea what they did. So I drove up to the front gate and said, here's a resume. Let's go.
I don't know what was wrong with all those high schools. They had a male who wanted to teach English literature and knew Jane Austen. I mean, wow. So
yeah, it's, you can't make it up.
All right. On a completely different point in your life, what was your job at the time of 9/11?
I was seconded to the White House on what's called the National Security Council, which is kind of the Foreign Policy Advisory Council for the president. A lot of people from around Washington, agencies, State Department, CIA, the Defense Department, are seconded to the White House to help with the National Security Council. I was working on Middle East stuff and actually having a cup of coffee. I came back and somebody said, there's a plane that went into a building. I assumed it was sort of a wayward Cessna in New York. And then I was watching live as the second one hit, and someone went down the hallway in the building. I was in the executive office building next to the West Wing of the White House and said, we think we might be next. So we, of course, evacuated. It was sort of unforgettable, almost like living a movie scene, but with an added element of tragedy that you just can't forget.
How much do you think the 9/11 Commission basically got it right about the failure to connect the dots and the failure of imagination that they said was at the heart of the failure to prevent this or, you know, any other of their major thrusts?
I thought that the narrative was quite good. I think that they overestimated the ability of any single security service to look at a problem of the magnitude of global terrorism. Look, the issue is until there's a catastrophic event in a democratic society, it's hard to get people to turn on a dime and say, we're going to change our entire foreign policy and make some changes in our culture, including everything from how you get on an airplane to how you intercept telephone calls, based on a threat information from the CIA. The world doesn't move like that. So I think there are mistakes. But to believe that we could have done something to stop a global revolution, which is what al-Qaeda is, before that catastrophic event, I don't think that would have been possible.
So given you that you had the position that you had, here's a history question. Did you work on the famous CIA daily brief or presidential daily brief in the summer of 2001 that Condoleezza Rice got pressed so hard on in congressional testimony? Al-Qaeda determined to strike inside U.S., and she took it as a generality rather than a specific warning. Did you write that by any chance?
I did not. I was actually at the White House then. Those documents were written by the people I later managed at the CIA. I'm aware of both the analyst and the document. I worked on a lot of spent a lot of time working on the president's daily brief, both before and after my White House assignment. I tend, by the way, to believe it or not, agree with Dr. Rice and her assessment of the document and what it meant.
And that's what I wanted to know. You got a very adventurous assignment to Afghanistan just after 9/11. To aid in the fight against al-Qaeda and the Taliban. What was your role at that time?
There was a very small diplomatic team led by an ambassador, Jim Dobbins, who's just been appointed again by President Obama to go out to Pakistan and Afghanistan again. Shortly after 9/11, the military campaign with the Northern Alliance, that is the Afghan opposition to the Taliban, was moving very quickly in the fall of 2001, and the diplomatic campaign was far behind. And so I think people start to ask a simple question. If there's a vacuum created by military success on the ground, who's going to be the next president of Afghanistan to fill the vacuum? So the ambassador was appointed. And I remember calling up CIA headquarters from my office at the White House saying, this is going to be the fight of a generation. I want in this game. And I was so surprised the call came back and said, you know, the ambassador is going to have a very small team of people from across U.S. government. And you can be the CIA guy on that team. And it was just Mr. Toad's wild ride from Disney World. It was an incredible experience.
How do you feel about the way the Afghanistan war is going now? It's been 12 years since you were there, almost 12 years, America's longest war. And we're still chasing al-Qaeda leaders in the mountains of the Afghanistan and Pakistan border region. Did we accomplish anything in terms of U.S. national security, in your opinion?
I think we did. If you ask the question of what Americans would have anticipated on September 12th of 2001, I think they would have anticipated much more catastrophic events than we have witnessed in the past 12 years. So, you know, I think there have been inefficiencies. I think we've been at war too long. We're fighting the Taliban. I don't think the Taliban is an enemy. I think we spent too many dollars, too much material, and too many lives in Afghanistan. But that said, I think anybody who reflects on what we all anticipated 12 years ago would have said a lot of problems with the execution of these campaigns and this counterterror war, but we actually kept a lot of Americans safe. It was very inefficient, and we made mistakes, but it didn't turn out as badly as you might have expected it back then.
You wrote an op-ed recently defending President Obama's use of drones in that region in so-called signature strikes. That is, for people who don't know the term, not on identified individuals, but on groups of people seen by satellites, I guess, looking like they were moving in the way that a terrorist group would. Is that how you would define a signature strike?
Sort of. I would take it a step further and say you should have positive information indicating that these people are sympathetic with or affiliated with, aligned with the group that you're at war with. So, for example, if you're looking at a group of men in Afghanistan or Pakistan, they're not just sort of looking like the adversary. You've got to take it a step further. You're dealing, I mean, I know it sounds rough, but you're dealing with a human life and a human soul. And the question can't simply be, are there broad signatures that suggest they're bad guys? The bar's got to be higher than that, but perhaps not as high as saying, I know one of them is Osama bin Laden or a senior operational commander for Al-Qaeda. That, to me, is too high a bar.
But when you target a group of people and you cannot identify individuals, you're bound to kill innocents, aren't you?
Yes, but one of the challenges here is that people tend to perceive drones, because of their sort of sexy Hollywood things, as somehow different than, for example, a mortar or a rifle fire, artillery. They're simply another way to deliver a kinetic strike. I may sound like the tough guy from CIA, but let me be clear. Americans have come to believe that somehow war is separate from tragedy. It is not, whether it's a drone or a piece of artillery. I would actually go further than most people would and say we need to be far more careful in determining when we want to get into war, because in the 21st century, we have to understand that war will never be separable from tragedy and from the loss of innocent life on either side, as long as you're using kinetic weapons. We want to say this is clean, drones are cleaner, no civilians will die. It's not true. War is rough.
President Obama seemed to promise a cutback in signature strikes in his Afghanistan and terrorism speech last month. What's your understanding of what will change?
I think he was right in saying that. We've got to get out of war in this country. We've got a lot bigger things to worry about. Childhood obesity. We've got problems in this country with nutrition, with exercise, with medical treatment for people who don't have coverage right now, with immigration. I think what he's saying is, if there's not an imminent threat from Al-Qaeda, we're not into forever wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and we've got to refocus. If we get out then, and I believe he was pretty clear on this, the need for signature strikes to defend our troops will obviously disappear. So if we see a point target that is an Al-Qaeda leader like the now-in-charge fellow, Ayman al-Zawahiri, I would imagine we'd shoot, but I don't see the reason to go after military targets when we won't have troops on the ground.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC with former top FBI and CIA counterterrorism official Philip Mudd, who has now written a book called Takedown, Inside the Hunt for Al-Qaeda. We'll get into Edward Snowden with him as we go. We'll get into Syria and whether we can arm the rebels without inadvertently arming Al-Qaeda. But we have a board full of calls. I did say anything you wanted to ask a former,
I said,
top FBI and CIA. They'll ask anything they want. You'll answer anything you want. I guess that's the deal. Let's take a few calls. Stephen in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, I have a question. Is probable cause always the right standard to be used against a continuum of terrorist attacks or terrorism, from just talking to actually implementing a plan? Because we need probable cause.
Do you mean for legal action or military
action? For surveillance.
Surveillance. Aha. Uh-huh. Okay, so he's getting into the surveillance question.
Yeah, boy, that's a tough. I think there's a difference between collecting information and having data that you can bounce against when you get a threat or probable cause, and actually looking at that information. So if I collect a phone number and put it in a black box and don't refer to it until it crops up into an investigation, I, as an American, would say, I have to think about it. I'm not sure I have a problem with that. If you're simply searching data to say, I see a pattern of behavior in America with American citizens that's of concern, as a former counterterrorism guy, I'd say that troubles me a bit. It's got to be information that takes you a step above sort of a pattern of activity that's of concern. What is that person doing wrong? Are they contemplating a violation of federal law? Did a source say that they were contemplating something? Did a Foreign Security Service say that person was communicating with a terrorist? I think we ought to take some risks to make sure that we maintain a free society where probable cause is the standard by which we look at human beings in the United States. The problem with that, and I'll close on this, is we have to man up. This is an R-rated movie, as my friend General Hayden would say. That is, there aren't children in the theater. This is for adults only. If you want to do that, there are people who will get through the net, and we have to accept that in an open society.
do you, and I understand that trade-off that you're describing there, and that's one of the most difficult questions facing our society today, I think. But do you buy the claims of the NSA director, Keith Alexander, that the NSA surveillance programs have prevented around 50 terrorist attacks?
Yes, but I think the question is poorly phrased, and I'm a bit surprised he answered it that bluntly. The way the world of counterterrorism works is collecting information that's more than a mosaic than simply an email address or a telephone number. That is, you're looking about at things like people's travel, you're looking at informant reports, you're looking at people's over time at people's purchases. For example, are they purchasing stuff from a beauty supply store that could be used in a backpack bomb? When you get information about an individual or a conspiracy, all that stuff goes into a big, ugly soup. And to take one threat out, whether it's a phone or an email, and say phones alone stop 50 attacks, I think offers a portrayal of the counterterrorism business that's much simpler than what I witnessed. I don't know what he's trying to do. He's trying to explain to the American people how important this stuff is, and it is important. But I think people are going to walk away with an oversimplified understanding of how counterterrorism works.
Elizabeth in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Philip Mudd. Hello.
Hey. I recently saw a film, I don't know if you've seen it, called Dirty Wars, and it really speaks a lot about the joint operations, the special ops group of military, elite military, and it's very troubling the way in which that works in all Middle Eastern countries and their ability to work without any oversight, home invasions, abductions, killing families, and then trying to cover it up. Can you comment on that? It's very troubling, and more people are beginning to learn about this secret part of the...
And this is showing in New York right now. Have you seen Dirty Wars, Mr. Mudd?
No, I actually don't. I watch almost nothing related to the life I once had. I find a lot of it misleading, whether it's factual or, you know, for example, I didn't see Zero Dark Thirty. I don't object to people seeing that stuff. I know it's fictional drama, but it's disturbing to see the people I worked with and the job I once had portrayed as sort of a violation of American values. That happens. We prosecuted people at CIA for making mistakes, and some of them were horrendous mistakes. As you know, people are being prosecuted and have been prosecuted in the military for violating the laws of war. So what the lady is saying happens. But to suggest that is kind of the fabric of how America operates overseas, I think is just a mistake. And it is the 21st century, but I still believe America is a great place, and that people who represent this country try their best. Those who make mistakes ought to be prosecuted, and prosecuted fully, thrown in jail forever if that's what it takes.
Well, am I correct that you were not confirmed to be the counterintelligence chief for the Department of Homeland Security, which President Obama wanted you for, because you may or may not have sent a detainee to another country for interrogation under the so-called Extraordinary Rendition Program, which might be one of those black ops things?
Yeah, that's sort of true. What happened was the oversight committees that were responsible for the position I was nominated for basically sent out a signal. This is how Washington works. It says, if you put this guy up in front of a nomination, which is a public hearing, we're going to nail his head to a wall. Not because of necessarily everything I did, but because I was the only nominee from the intelligence community, from the CIA, who knew about all those programs. So I think the oversight committee said, it's our only shot at a CIA guy, whether or not he was responsible for all this, he knows about it. And we're going to question him about everything. And my answer was, personally, I'd like that. Bring it on. Professionally, I don't know the president. He was nice enough to nominate me. I thought professionally the responsible thing to do was to say, I'll withdraw my nomination if you want to make a congressional hearing a circus. And that's what I thought was going to happen.
Well, I wonder if one of the questions they would have asked you would be the rendition program itself was controversial because it's believed to be the reason we send detainees to other countries. That is, the reason that we send detainees to other countries for interrogation is believed to be to circumvent U.S. human rights standards when questioning them. Is that accurate?
That's just dead wrong. There's an appropriate question among Americans, and that should be, is it okay to send a foreign prisoner to a place like Egypt or Syria or Lebanon, wherever you want to say, that's a fair question. But to suggest that we as Americans secretly sit there around a table and say, wink, wink, we're going to send this guy to a prison so he can get his ass kicked, by a foreign security service because we can't do that. That it just doesn't happen.
So why would we use another country?
There, you got three things to do with somebody you hold. That is, keep them yourself. That's places like Gitmo. Let them go or send them home. So if you have a guy who's too low-level or mid-level for you to prosecute or to keep in a war zone in a place like Pakistan, Afghanistan, I'd say then you have two options. Let him go or send him home to a place like, again, Egypt or Syria. So my question is, what do you want us to do? When the home country says, we will certify you to you that we will treat this person humanely, then I have an option that says I either accept their agreement. We're not stupid. We're not naive. I know there's a risk to doing that. But then the alternative is to let this guy go, and he's going to go shoot American soldiers in Afghanistan. What do you want me to do?
We'll continue in a minute with Philip Mudd, author of Takedown, Inside the Hunt for Al-Qaeda. More of your questions for this former top counterterrorism official at the FBI and the CIA. Going to play you a Glenn Greenwald clip after the break, Mr. Mudd, and see what you think about Syria as well. Stay with us, Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. My guest is former top counterterrorism official with the FBI and the CIA, Philip Mudd. He was sent to Afghanistan just after 9/11. Maybe you heard him describe that. He was nominated by President Obama to head counterterrorism for the Department of Homeland Security. He had high positions in the Bush and Clinton administration, and he's now out of government and has written a book, Takedown, Inside the Hunt for Al-Qaeda. And here is journalist Glenn Greenwald on Meet the Press yesterday. Of course, he got some of Edward Snowden's leaks with the Guardian newspaper. Snowden questions the need for secret surveillance that is only passed judgment on by secret courts, and that's what Greenwald talks about in this clip.
I don't know what government officials are whispering to you, David, but I know that the documents that I have in my possession and that I have read from the NSA tell a much different story, which is that there was an 80-page opinion from the FISA court that said that what the NSA is doing in spying on American citizens is a violation of both the Fourth Amendment and the bounds of the statute. And it specifically said that they are collecting bulk transmissions, multiple conversations from millions of Americans, not just people that are believed to be involved in terrorist organizations or working for a foreign agent, and that this is illegal. And the NSA then planned to try and accommodate that ruling. But I think the real issue as journalists and as citizens is, why should we have to guess? How can we have a democracy in which a secret court rules that what the government is doing in spying on us is a violation of the Constitution and the law, and yet we sit here and don't know what that ruling is because it's all been concealed and all been secret?
Glenn Greenwald on Meet the Press with David Gregory yesterday. And I wonder, Mr. Mudd, how much you agree with Glenn Greenwald, at least on that point, that here is an entirely secret program that is only judged by an entirely secret court. And do we really need to do that in our democracy?
I think this is a debate, the debate we're having now in the 21st century about what Americans expect in terms of privacy when they look at, you know, Amazon or Yahoo, that's perfectly appropriate. But to suggest that this is an entirely secret sort of semi-rogue operation, it just doesn't bear out. Look, you have the legislative branch that passed a law that said this is okay, and they have the oversight authority to talk to NSA about how that law is executed. You have the judicial branch, that is the FISA court, the secret court, that looks at applications from the National Security Agency, and you have the executive branch, that is the White House, that has authorized this. So to say this is some sort of draconian measure that's not known by many people, that's sort of a rogue operation, the three branches of government in our democracy have looked at this and said it's okay. If people don't think it's okay, I think the Congress should look at it and pass a law against it. It's not that complicated.
If the surveillance programs are basically universal, these ones that have been revealed, wouldn't any terrorist assume, or wouldn't they assume anyway, that their phone calls and computer activity are being watched? I ask because what intelligence advantage is lost? What did Edward Snowden really give up in terms of national security by saying out loud what every terrorist probably already knows? Electronic communications are watchable and are being watched.
well, you might be surprised at my answer. I don't think this is a bad debate to be had. And some of what he's talking about, for example, what he revealed in terms of American operations versus the Chinese, I thought was quite damaging. But to say that we're collecting a lot of internet and phone activity, to me, isn't necessarily threatening the country, especially when you balance it against the need to have a public debate about this issue, which I think is fair. There is a separate issue, though, and like me, this fellow took an oath, and not only did he violate the oath, he violated a federal law. This is not a rogue operation that he's exposing. This is collection that's authorized by courts, that's overseen by the Congress of the United States, under laws passed by the Congress. And as someone who took that oath, I just can't accept what he did. This is not a whistleblower. This is someone who leaked classified information. But, if he wants to blow a whistle, go to whistleblower status.
But on the question of what he actually revealed that damages national security, wouldn't any terrorist assume that everything they do online and everything they do on a phone line is being monitored?
That's what I'm saying. I'm agreeing with you. I think the answer is probably yes, but that's not the only thing he revealed, obviously.
Right. He did reveal a particular program of cyber spying against China.
Yeah.
Which you think that harms us with China, or does it just harm our public relations when we're trying to accuse China of the same thing?
We're actually not accusing them of the same thing. There's a difference between looking at the security apparatus of a country, which is what we might do with China, and stealing secrets, including intellectual property, from across America, which is what I believe China's up to. There's a difference between stealing from civilian programs and trying to understand your military adversary. So I don't see it as equal, but I do think he damaged the ability of the president to have a meaningful conversation with the Chinese about this issue.
Benjamin in Orangeburg, you're on WNYC with Philip Mudd. Hello, Benjamin.
Thank you. Let me just preface this by saying, Mr. Mudd, a lot of what you're saying sounds very sanitized to me. I lived through the Vietnam era, and I lived through Watergate. And many of your statements echo what government officials said during those periods.
If you're going to make an accusation, though, be specific.
Well, let me go
to Watergate. Watergate wasn't overseen by a court, and it wasn't overseen by the Congress of the United States. How can you compare the two?
I can compare that, but by saying there was much government oversight of the Vietnam War. The Vietnam War had a lot of support from Democrats. It was definitely a bipartisan policy, and there was and that's why what Ellsberg did was so important and so patriotic and so necessary for our country. He exposed the narrative. The narrative was a lie.
All right. But you had a question about Yemen also, right?
I did. I would want to ask Mr. Mudd if he's read the book, Last Refuge. It's a almost day-by-day account of your drone program there. And the book states that before the drone program began, you estimated there were 300 jihadis in Yemen, and now there are 3,000 by the CIA's own estimate. Isn't this proof that the drone program just makes things worse?
Thank you, Benjamin. Philip Mudd?
No, I don't buy that in the least. The reason is quite simple. When you look at a terrorist adversary and how they grow by having the time and space to plan what we call safe haven, and they grow with visionary leadership. I'm not talking about everyday jihadis. I'm talking about visionary leaders who understand the ideology of al-Qaeda, target what they call the far enemy, that is Washington or Tel Aviv or London. It's hard to find those people in terrorist organizations, and it's very hard to replace them quickly. What drones give you, whether it's Somalia, Mali, Yemen, Afghanistan, or Pakistan, is ability to eliminate leadership, not entire organizations, but leadership faster they can replicate themselves. And in my world, there's no question about the success of the destruction of leadership in these organizations.
I guess the balance that people debate is whether the blowback around the world from the drone program and its reputation creates more on-the-ground terrorists than it discourages, even as it kills some of the leaders. Do you have an opinion about that?
It's a fair debate to say. I mean, it's a tough debate because I think the technology has gotten ahead of the policy to say when is an intervention appropriate. For example, you look at Mali, northern Nigeria, where you have sort of nascent terrorist organizations. When do you decide that you want to intervene if you decided that you can't wait for them to come attack America? I think that's a really important 21st century question that we haven't resolved yet.
So with all your experience in the hunt for al-Qaeda, is al-Qaeda on the run?
Yes, but the organization that conducted the attacks of 911 has been decimated. But we have to understand, it's not the word organization is misleading. It's a revolutionary movement that metastasized in places like Indonesia, Yemen, Somalia. All those threat locations from 911, those dispersed locations in South and Southeast Asia through Africa and the Middle East, have had the al-Qaeda affiliates damaged as well. The problem is that even those affiliates are down, the ideology still lives. So you never know when there's going to be a spark after a sort of forest fire of al-Qaeda that will rise again, which is kind of what we're seeing in northern Nigeria right now. So, yeah, they're down. The affiliates are down. But I don't think the fight is over yet.
What do you think about the Syria situation? Can we thread the needle in the way advocates want to arm and train rebels not affiliated with al-Qaeda while many of their allies are?
No, I don't think that's possible. I think it's possible to do a good job, but there's no way you're going to have that job done perfectly. For example, if you give weapons to rebels, what's the guarantee they won't resell them to someone else? I would caution, though, for those who are listening, that there's a distinction between al-Qaeda and al-Qaeda. That is, someone who decides to raise an al-Qaeda flag in Syria because he likes the brand name isn't necessarily identical to someone like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the architect of 911, who's contemplating sending planes into New York City. Al-Qaeda has a brand name that people like. That doesn't mean when people say they're al-Qaeda, they adopt every one of al-Qaeda's ideas.
We'll get one more call in, and it's Michael in Queens. Michael, you're on the air. Hi.
Yes, good morning. Director Mutt, I wanted to ask you, how do we actually have, as you said previously on the PBS Charlie Rose show, how do we have a real mature conversation in the United States of America to where the American public has realistic expectations that the intelligence and national security community are doing on their behalf to keep them safe, and that the intelligence and national security community understand and know that it's about, like yourself, under professionals, you take your oath to uphold the U.S. Constitution, the civil liberties and civil rights of the country, and that there's respect for the professionals by the public, and then respect from the government to the public.
I think this is a two-way street. I'll give you a quick answer to that, but before I give you the answer, let me tell you something. Part of the responsibility lies with the American people, and I'm one of them now in the private sector. You can't be 3 days out of Boston in the attack on the marathon as we were, and I did every media outlet in the country virtually, and have people already saying, where was the intelligence mistake, when you've got two young guys who are brothers who decide to do the most basic plot ever with pressure cookers. We've got to have a little resilience in this country. The answer to your question, I think, is twofold. First, the conversation has to start with what kind of data do you retain without looking at it? That is, if you have a big black box of data out there that's things like phone numbers, email, et cetera, are Americans comfortable with us having that sea of data without accessing it? The second and more interesting question, I think, is when can you access that data? What is your bar to determine whether an individual or a conspiracy is worth going into that data to mine it? Should we look at that data before we have good probable cause? I think we can have that conversation without revealing what we call in the intelligence business sources and methods. But I divide what you collect and what you analyze into two separate bins because they're very different to me.
Well, as the caller suggests, it's difficult to have a mature conversation about these topics. There are so many people yelling and screaming past each other, and hopefully we can have some of it on this show, and hopefully the country is up to it as a whole. I want to thank Philip Mudd, former top counterterrorism official at the FBI and the CIA, now the author of Takedown, Inside the Hunt for Al-Qaeda, and he's now with the New America Foundation, for giving us this much time today. By the way, to end maybe on a lighter note, Isaiah from Philadelphia writes on our webpage, question for guest, how do you remember everything you're not allowed to say once you're out and writing books?
That's a pretty darn good question. You know, after you do it for 25 years, you can sort of sort, there's a big difference between revealing information and explaining a problem to Americans. To me, I'm not talking about the information we collected or how we collected it. I'm trying to help Americans understand a campaign that's part of their lives. And believe it or not, it's not that hard to sort through in my mind, and I haven't been rapped on the knuckles by the CIA since I've been out of government for talking to people like this show. So fingers crossed, we'll see if I can keep doing it.
Did you have to run your book by government officials?
Yes, I did. We all take an oath to do that when I went to CIA. They changed almost nothing, mostly because I didn't want to tell any secrets and I didn't want to throw anybody under the bus. So that's why, you know, it hasn't been a New York Times bestseller, but I hope people understand if they read it. I don't think it's a good idea to do those things. I just hope to give people a window on how the world of threat and counterterrorism works.
Well, thanks again for coming on. I hope we can talk again.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, we will parse the affirmative action decision that came down this morning from the United States Supreme Court. Stay tuned.